So we're kicking off our marriage and family month, and I don't think that I really need to tell you guys why we need to come back and talk about this. I mean, we can all feel kind of the slippage in American values related to the family. So, you know, for us to come back again and talk about it year after year is probably not a surprise to anybody. I mean, just as a for instance, if you think back just a couple weekends ago when Chicago had 75 murders in the same weekend, I listened to all kinds of people getting on the news, and they're talking about, okay, here's the big solution, here's what we got to do. They're talking about everything from gun regulation, we need safer schools, we need more police, we need all of these things. And when I look at those kinds of scenarios, I come to a pretty quick conclusion what the problem is. So as I listened to the experts getting on the news and talking about it, they began to go from, okay, here's the problem, to here's the solution. And one guy got on, a guy named Philip Jackson, who's the founder and executive director of what's called the Black Star Project. Here's what he said, talking about Chicago. He said, the most important reason parts of the South and West sides are the way they are is the breakdown of the family. He says, you can't have a strong society without strong families. Now, this is an unbeliever that's looking at the problem in Chicago, and he says, the problem really isn't gun violence. The problem really isn't schools and police and all of that. The problem is the family. Now, for us, we would sit there and we would listen to that, just like I did, and we'd kind of go, well, yeah, that's because God designed it that way. There's no surprise there. But when he said that, there were all these people going, wow, that's so brilliant. Why are we surprised when we find out that God's way is the best way? It always is. But what is always surprising to me is this. Our culture has certain values when it comes to marriage and family. Many of those values are very different than God's values. But what is surprising is how we as Christians seem to align statistically pretty close to the values we see in our own society. That's why we have to come back to the watering hole year after year after year and remind ourselves that God sets out a standard for marriage. He sets out a standard for the family. And just because culture is saying one thing, that doesn't change God's standard. And we got to come back and we got to take a look at it from time to time, which, you know, we really shouldn't be surprised that our view of marriage is so different from God's. When Jesus was walking around here, he started talking to his disciples at one point about marriage. And when he got done, the disciples said this, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry. In other words, they listened to what Jesus said about the ideal that God sets for marriage, and they say it's impossible. There's no way. And if that's the ideal, why would anybody get married? Why would anybody do this? So God sets out this ideal. And I think if we're honest, here's what happens with us as Christians. We hear God's ideal, the standard, we see it on this side and we know it. But then there's the cultural values, what we see in movies, we read in books, what we hear in school, hear from our neighbors. And these two values are not congruent. They're not the same. And so what happens for us Christians is we get stuck in the middle and we feel pulled back and forth both directions. And what I want us to do in this series is I want us to run to God's standard, and I want us to turn our back to the values in our culture that do not align with God's values when it comes to marriage and the family. That's all I want out of this series. So we're coming back to God's standard. And we want to unashamedly, with passion, with desire, run to God's ideal for marriage and say that's what we want to do. So I want to start with a disclaimer. If you've been married for 60 years and you've been in the church, you've heard a lot of sermons, a lot of messages, a lot of series on marriage. I have. I've not been married 60 years. I've heard a lot of sermons. I've given a lot. Here's the problem. 95% of them, they all say the same thing. Not that that's terribly bad, but I don't want us to run down the same path that we've run down many times. So what I do is I take a more direct path. And I'm not asking for permission to do that. I'm telling you that I'm going to do that. So I will say things up here this month that maybe typically in a pulpit church people don't say, because we tend to speak in generalities. We tend to speak, you know, just a little bit here and summarize here because we don't want to offend anybody. Listen, I don't care if God's values offend you. I don't care at all. So I'm going to say what I think God wants me to say, and I want you guys to feel with me just a little bit of like nervous uneasiness when it comes to it. Otherwise, we're just running down the same path we've all run down before. So I'm not asking you for permission, but I am saying that this month especially, I may say things that are outside of general sensibilities or whatever when it comes to church, because I want this sermon to be helpful, and I want this series to be good for us. And I think that there is urgency in the hour when it comes to the marriages and families that we have. So there's no reason to beat around the bush. Let's get serious. Let's say it like it needs to be said, and let's work on it for our great satisfaction. God invented the marriage, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but he invented it for our good. So if we do it his way, we maximize our satisfaction in this great thing that God designed. So I'm just going to put it out there, okay? And if I maybe cross a line, forgive me. I want it to be for our good. So with that great disclaimer, you guys are all kind of nervous. Did you see my title today? Naked and Afraid? You're already nervous, right? All right, so grab your Bibles and go to Genesis 2 with me. Genesis 2. I'm going to read these verses that are pretty familiar to us. Typically, though, we hear them at weddings, maybe renewal of vows. But I'm going to read these, and then we're going to talk about specifically one verse. Verse 18, chapter 2, verse 18, Genesis 2, verse 18 says, "Then the Lord God said, 'It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make a helper fit for him.' Now out of the ground the Lord had formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all livestock and all the birds of heaven and every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found a helper fit for him. So the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept he took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to man. Then the man said, 'This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed.'" So I want to focus in on verse 25. I'm going to read it again, because you probably never heard a sermon in verse 25. It says, "And the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed." Now, maybe it's the guy in me, but every time I read that verse, I smile. Now, all of you women are going, "Such a guy thing to say. I can't believe you would say that." I think that we see all of God's design for marriage in verse 25. Now, again, you women are going, "Oh, that's so typical for a guy." So what I want to do is, before I talk about this verse, I want to address the women that are going, "That's such a guy thing to say something like that," or even to choose verse 25, or even to put that title up, "Naked and Afraid." Here's why I want to begin. Women, God designed men's eyes to be attracted to the female body. Now, that's probably not earth-shattering. I know you women at times, maybe most of the time, think it's annoying. But listen, husbands, the next time she rolls your eyes at your advances, just say, "This is the way God made me. It's not my fault. Blame him, not me." So here's what I want to say about that. God made men's eyes to be attracted to the female body, which means, women, God made your husband's eyes to be attracted to your body. And I know you might say, "Well, it doesn't look like it used to." Doesn't matter. I know you think it's annoying sometimes. Doesn't matter. This is the way God designed men to be. And their eyes are for your body. So from a practical point of view, let me just put it out there a little bit, because it's a perfect example of where I want to actually get. Women, if you don't want your husband to make advances at you at night, don't get dressed for bed in front of him. Okay? Why? Because God made his eyes to be attracted to your body. And you may not always like it, you may never like it, but it is how God designed his eyes to be. So respect it. But what this means, guys, is that God designed your eyes to be attracted to your wife's body alone. Not all bodies, that's the natural side. Her body and her body alone. Which means, guys, that we have to fight for that. Because our natural tendency and the way that God designed us is to see, to watch, to observe, to look at. But once you get married, you make a commitment that your eyes will be for one person and one person only. So you have to practice this, guys. Can I just put it out there and just from a practical point of view? You have to practice what I call the eye bounce. Here's the eye bounce. You're at a football game. You're walking. Attractive female coming at you. Your mind, because of the way God made you, your mind wants to check out this wonderful creature. But your commitment to your wife says, I have eyes only for her. So what do? You eye bounce. And the eye bounce goes, look and bounce away. Now, it seems really simple, but every man sitting here knows exactly what I mean. You have to practice the eye bounce. So we're going to practice the eye bounce, okay? So I'm going to put up a picture, and guys, I want you to practice the eye bounce. Ladies, feel free to look at the picture all you want, okay? So we're going to practice the eye bounce. You guys all ready to eye bounce? Here's the picture. This is Nick Drake in a dress. Now, try your best to bounce your eyes away from that. Children, don't look at it. The therapy will be needed. But you get my idea. And every single one of you guys knows exactly what I'm talking about. Because God designed our eyes to be attracted to the female body. But your eye as a married man has to be for one person only. And so literally, guys, can I just tell you what you got to do? You're at that football game, she's walking at you, your eye bounce away. You literally have to tell your mind, you have to say, don't look, don't look, don't look. Look the other way, look the other way, look the other way. I'm not going to look. And when she's passed, you do a little jig. I did it. And your wife says, well, what are you so happy about? You say, oh, I'm just so happy to be married to you, honey. That's funny. So here's the truth, guys. You can feed the habit of looking, or you can feed the habit of bouncing your eyes away. And whatever you feed, that will be your habit. As a married man, God designed your eyes to look at all. You have to fight to keep your eyes on your wife alone. And you got to feed that habit. And can I just say, guys, every time you stare at a woman's body who is not your wife, you dishonor your wife. Every time. And it doesn't matter if it's a live woman at a football game. It doesn't matter if it's on a movie. It doesn't matter if it's internet pictures. You dishonor her by feeding the habit of looking where your eyes are not supposed to be. And you can say, oh, I don't want to get caught. Oh, it's a bad whatever. But at the bottom line, you dishonor your wife if your eyes are looking at things like pornography. You dishonor her and the commitment you made to her. And it doesn't matter that guys' eyes have been made for all women. In marriage, you make a commitment to have eyes for one person only. So which, the flip side of that is to the ladies' side. If we have a bunch of guys that are trying to work on this habit, of bouncing their eyes away, to keeping their eyes only for their wives. It means, ladies, that you can help us poor guys out by wearing and dressing modestly. There are some things that need to be covered up and enjoyed by your husband only. Help us by dressing that way. Okay, now that I got that out of the way, let's get back to the sermon. Because that's all really fun stuff, right? We could talk about that for a long time. Let's get back to Genesis 2. In Genesis 2, in the story that we read, God creates marriage. Now, it was his idea. He invented it. As the creator, he has the right to define what marriage is. And he defines it this way. One man, one woman, one lifetime. One man, one woman, one lifetime. That is God's ideal. And he designed it that way. And really, if you look at that really closely, God was the first father to give away a bride at a wedding. He brings Eve to Adam, you know, who gives this woman to be married to this man. God says, I do. Which is really funny if you think about it, because I've done a lot of weddings, been at a lot of weddings, and the father of the bride at a wedding has one line. Have you ever heard the guy, poor guy, mess up the one line? I have. Because her mother and I, and the guy freezes in the moment and he goes, and he's thinking grammatically, she and me, her and me, that woman over there and me. I heard one father literally say, I do, which is the wrong moment to say, I do. And what he didn't realize is that his wife's eyes were boring a hole in his head and from behind. It was great. So God designed marriage. And we got to start there because God designed it. He created it. He invented it. He's like has the patent on marriage. But don't just blow that off. Because we're living in a moment right now in our history, in our country, where our government believes it has the right to define marriage. It does not. Because marriage was not something that was culturally created. It wasn't created in a society. There weren't some people laying around going, hey, let's come up with an idea. God designed marriage. So it doesn't matter if the government comes along and says it can be 5 other things or 10 other things. At the baseline, God says, I know what it is. I invented it. I have the patent on it. God designed marriage. And that's where this has to all start. You're not married just because you have a piece of paper. There's a license. It's something so much more than that. So I want you to hear me very clearly. God designed marriage according to his good pleasure, for his glory, and ultimately for our good. God designed marriage. He came up with the idea. But it was according to his plan, for his glory, and for our good. And I think we see this in the story. I want to just paint this story for you. If you look through the story in verse 18, 19, and 20, God says, it's not good that man should be alone. He kind of has to prove his point. He takes all the animals, parades all the animals in front of Adam. He takes a look at him. Adam looks at all the animals and kind of gets in his little whiny voice and says, well, what about me? There's nobody like me out here. And God then, verse 21, puts him in a deep sleep, takes a rib, and makes the woman from that rib. Now, we could rehash all the bad jokes about this, and there are tons of them out there. Like, God took a rib out of Adam's side, and women have been a pain in men's side ever since, you know, as that's out there. God made Adam and thought, oh, I can do better the second time. So then he makes Eve. And, you know, all of those stories, we could do that. But what I want you to see is why God created Eve. Why did he create her? Why did he do it this way? For all the rest of the creation, God's like, animals, plants, sun, moon, and stars. But he did it differently when it came to the woman. Why did he do it differently? He could have done lots of things, but instead he took a rib, it says, and just as a funny thing, this word rib here is a very complicated Hebrew word. It's only used one time in all the Bible, and it's right here. It's a word that could be singular, or it could be plural. So he might have taken a rib, he might have taken more than one rib. Somebody suggested he took a whole half side, which would be really weird. I'm not sure how that works, but I think part of the idea that God has from the beginning is that man and woman together find their completeness, wholeness, oneness together. And that's how God designed it to be. So then God brings the woman to man, man and wife, man and woman. They're there together. They're naked. And they're unashamed. That's verse 25. But I want to fast forward in the story now to verse 10. Look what it says in verse 10. This is after Adam and Eve, they eat of the fruit. Verse 10 says, and this is God, and he said, verse 9, the Lord God called the man and said, where are you? And he said, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, I hid myself. So in verse 25, chapter 2, you have man and wife together, naked, unashamed, and happy. Verse 10, 10 verses later, you have man and wife together, naked, but now they're afraid. Now they're not happy, but they are hiding. So let me ask you the question. Why were they ashamed? Why were they, like, what caused their shame? Now I want us to think about that a little bit because I think it's so important as we come back to God's design in all of this. Many people estimate that by this point of the story, by the time that they fell, by the time they had to, you know, sew clothes and all of that, they'd been married for at least 20 years, if not more. Some say much, much longer. So they have 20 years of marriage together. But all of a sudden, they're ashamed. All of a sudden, they feel shame in being with each other. Some suggest that they, for the very first time, saw their nakedness. Now, I'm pretty sure after all those years of marriage, Adam noticed that Eve was naked at least once. Pretty sure on that one. So I don't think that's true. Other people suggest that maybe there was all of a sudden a physical manifestation, like, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Adam has like a big defect on his cheek. I guess either cheek would work, on his cheek. And she never noticed. We read nothing about some like immediate physical change that they went through. In fact, they were still perfect in body, perfect in form, even after they sinned. So that can't be. Others have suggested this was the first fight that we find in the Bible, and now they're hiding and they're in isolation. But it says that when God came and talked to them that they were hiding together. So I don't think that's true. So why were they so ashamed all of a sudden? So let's answer that and maybe take it from a different tact. A little more direct, maybe. Nakedness in marriage becomes very normal over time. And whether it's getting out of the shower, getting dressed in the morning, whatever it is, it just is part of the marriage experience. But what happens is that most feel a certain level of shyness in that. Probably none of us are walking around naked all the time, especially after you have kids. It doesn't work very well. But why? Well, inside of us, there is this fear of appearing imperfect for this man or this woman that we love. We don't want to appear inadequate. We don't want them to see imperfections. And so we cover it up. We feel at times ashamed that way. However, in the case of Adam and Eve, their bodies were completely naked, completely perfect. And yet, there was shame. Yet, they were ashamed. And really, there's a really good lesson in that, because if you've ever thought, man, if I had a perfect body, then I would feel much more free with my spouse. Well, the truth is, you probably wouldn't. But here's why they're ashamed. And this just gets us right into the design of God. They were ashamed because I think Eve realized in that moment, for the very first time ever, that if her husband so quickly rejected God, that maybe he would reject her as well. And Adam realized for the very first time that if Eve was so quick to reject God, maybe she would reject him too. And I think in this scenario, we see how God's design, this perfect design that he had for marriage, was violated, and how every marriage ever since, man and wife now feel this edge, this sense of rejection, this fear that our spouse, whether it's naked in the real sense or naked in the figurative sense, they're going to see us for who we really are. And if they do, what's going to happen? Will they reject us? Will they run away from us? Will they leave? And I think we feel that. So God designed marriage a different way. He designed marriage to be this lifetime covenant between a man and a wife, a husband and a wife, a man and a woman. But that covenant, he says, reflects the covenant between Christ and his church. So there's a design in what happens in marriage that's supposed to reflect what the reality is already in heaven. He expects then that man and wife will keep their promises. Now say it with me, keep their promises in the same way that Christ keeps his promise. How does Christ keep his promise? He says, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. I will never break a promise. I will never reject you. Sometimes there could be distance, but you are mine forever. And he says, that's the covenant. That's the kind of marriage between a woman and a husband and a wife that reflects the reality of heaven. One man, one woman, one lifetime reflects what Christ said. This is how I love my church. And we see this in Ephesians 5, well-known passage, Ephesians 5, 31. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. The two shall become one flesh. But he says the mystery is profound because he's actually talking about Christ and the church. And I think that's the reason God values the marriage covenant so highly. Because he says it represents his love for the church, which is why divorce is so horrific in God's eyes. Because it improperly reflects the love that Christ has for his church. And it's not merely that it involves, you know, this covenant breaking, but it misrepresents Christ. Because Christ will never leave his bride. Ever. He always keeps his promise. So marriage, in the design of God, is supposed to show that. And it's supposed to show that not just living in the same house together, not just coexisting together, not just having some kind of like fraternal friendship with your spouse. It's supposed to show that at all levels of the marriage. It's supposed to reflect, and we're going to talk about this next week in the Die to Self, which is next week's sermon. It's supposed to reflect how Christ loves the church at all levels of the marriage. So let me state a couple things just categorically and plainly for us at this point. Number one, husbands, in a God-honoring marriage, the safest person in your life should be your wife. And wives, in a God-honoring marriage, the safest person in your life should be your husband. Safe in the emotional sense. Safe in the, I hurt you, please forgive me, let me be the first to restore, as Dave was talking about. Safe in the, I'm going to let you see all my warts and moles and imperfections, both physically and emotionally and otherwise, and I still feel safe with you. Safe in the sense that I can tell you my struggles. I can fail in front of you, and you will never, ever leave me. Safe in the, I know for sure that there is nothing that I can do that will ever make you abandon me. Safe in every way. That's how God designed marriages to be. But let me ask you, if I were to say, what's the biggest fear that a husband or a wife has in the marriage? The answer is probably that I'm going to be left. I'm going to be abandoned. That they're going to leave me. That's why God's design of this covenant that's a lifetime, no questions asked covenant, what it does is it erases the biggest fear that a man and a woman would have together in a marriage. If the biggest fear is he could leave me, but in a covenant relationship, he will never leave me, then I don't ever have to fear that he will run away. He will ever reject me. He will belittle me. He will post on Facebook this thing. He will talk bad about his friends about me. I never have to worry about that because I have him forever and I can trust that. Our spouses should be the safe sphere for us. So covenant love erases what I think is probably the biggest fear that couples face in marriage, and that is abandonment. Covenant says, you're mine forever, no matter what comes. Second thing I want to say is that And it's become a very famous phrase, that covenant, marriage is about covenant keeping, not about staying in love. I want to say this again, and I want to say it somewhat gently but directly. If a Christian friend of yours says to you, let's say she's married, that I have fallen in love with another man, you know what you should say to her? Go home to your husband. That's what you should say. That's the biblical response. And sometimes we get it all messed up with emotions and all these other things. But the most God-honoring response to someone who says, I've fallen in love with somebody who's not my spouse, is to say, go home, keep your promise. Go home, don't be a liar. Go home, have eyes only for your spouse. Go home. It's not to feed, oh, your husband is this, oh, your wife is this, oh, if I was married to him or I was married to her or whatever. It's to say, go home, keep your promise. You're a covenant keeper. Go home and keep your promise. That's what marriage is about. And I think that there are 100 ways to honor our husbands and wives and 1,000 ways to dishonor them. And so, I think that generally, our wives are better at honoring us than we are at honoring them. So I want to come back again, and I want to say, you know why you should stay away from porn? You know why you need to work at the eye bounce at a football game? You know why you want to talk well of your wife when you're with your friends? You know why you want to care more about her happiness than your happiness? The reason is you fear dishonoring your wife. That's part of keeping this covenant that God has designed for marriage. And sometimes we try to talk about all kinds of things. And I sometimes, you know, quite honestly, I think computer filters are good things and things like that on your phones, guys. But I think that we have lost this sense of dishonoring our wife. And so we kind of have a placebo in a computer filter and other things. And those are good things, don't get me wrong. But if we don't care about honoring her, all we're going to do is find a way to get around those filters. We've got to get back to the sense that God has entrusted to me in this moment this precious wife, this precious husband, and I get to care for him, care for her all of my days. And why? Why would I ever do anything that would dishonor this precious thing that God has given me for a lifetime? And if we lose that, it doesn't matter how many filters we have in our computer. God has given our spouses to us to honor. So listen, you cannot honor God with your life and dishonor your husband or wife at home or anywhere else. You can't. It's impossible. Which is why, and I'm running out of time, but see, I would argue from just a practical point of view that there are all kinds of things that need to happen and not happen at home. Here's one of the things that shouldn't happen at home. If you're trying to live in this God-honoring, covenant-keeping relationship, this commitment for a lifetime, if you're really concerned about honoring your husband, honoring your wife at all times, there are some things that should never happen in your home. You should never yell and scream. You should never throw tantrums. You should never swear. You should never raise a hand. Those things have no place ever in the life of a believer who's really trying to do God's design for marriage. Ever. So be covenant keepers. And one of the things that is so healthy or unhealthy in a marriage is this. Is sometimes we take this covenant keeping idea and we try to leverage it. I've heard this so many times. People want to talk about this fight going on. And what I find is the husband or the wife, one or the other, actually uses this as kind of a cudgel, a bat, where they say, well, if you don't do this, then I'm going to leave you. Don't ever threaten divorce. Don't ever threaten that you're going to leave. Don't ever threaten to shack up with somebody else. Because in a covenant-keeping lifetime commitment, those have no place ever in a conversation among Christians. I'm out of time. I need to keep on going. Last thing I want to say, number three, it's only in an environment of covenant-keeping trust that spouses will feel completely open to be vulnerable with each other, to be unafraid, to be unashamed, to be, in a sense, naked and unafraid. You see, I don't think anybody gets married hoping for a divorce or that the marriage will end, but statistics say about half do. And sometimes I wonder if we shouldn't change some of the vows that we have at our marriages. We say for better, for worse, for richer, for poor, sickness and in health. We say for a lifetime. And it really means that about half those that get married these days are actually lying when they get up and they say those things. It's a lie, because they don't intend to do that. So I think that the great desire that we all have is to get back to what we find in the Garden of Eden before the fall. Husband, wife, together, naked, emotionally and otherwise, and happy together. I think that's what everybody wants. They want a place that's safe. They want a place where they can be themselves and be vulnerable and fail and never, ever have even the hint of worry that this is like the proverbial straw and now he's leaving. That has no place among us. So can you imagine this place that God has designed? Can you imagine living in that kind of a place where you could be completely free? You could be completely vulnerable, completely open with fears and shortcomings. And you know that he will never laugh, never belittle, that she will never talk to her friends about it, that there is this sphere, this cocoon of trust, and you live within that cocoon. Can you imagine a place where sexuality can be explored without baggage? Can you imagine a place where each person in this cocoon would rather be with each other than anybody else on the planet? Can you imagine this place where the best memories of an entire lifetime are made with the same person? Can you imagine a place where there is no fear, there is no yelling, there's no conflict in the home that is ongoing? Can you imagine a place where this cocoon reflects the perfect love of Christ for his church? Can you imagine getting to the end of your life? And can you imagine being on your deathbed and your spouse leans over and in your last words you say, "The best thing about this life has been you." Imagine that place. God calls that marriage, and he designed it to be wonderful. He designed it to be for our good. He designed it to be satisfying. He designed it to be more than we could even imagine, which is why after 25 years and a couple months, I'll married for 25 years, I can't believe how good it's been. But I can't even imagine another 25. I sometimes tell couples in premarital counseling, I say, you're going to get to 5 years. You think it's going to be good? Just wait. You get to 20 years. You think it's going to be good? It can't get any better. Just wait. Then you get to 40, and you realize that the deepest parts of love and the best parts of marriage are reserved for those who do it for a lifetime. They do it God's way. It's the way he designed it. So, naked and unafraid at any level only works in an environment of covenant-keeping trust that God designed and calls marriage. Now, I want to say one other thing, and we're going to be done. My time's way past, but I want to say this, and I worked at how I wanted to say it. So, I want to say that God paints a picture of an amazing, blissful relationship between a husband and wife, and he calls us all in that relationship to be married for a lifetime. However, sin infects everything. It infects our marriages, both those that are together and those that are no longer together, which is why God allows for divorce in certain situations, not all situations, but in certain situations. So what I want to say is that if you've gone through a divorce, or maybe are right now are in a very painful separation, and even as I talk about this God's ideal, this wonderful sphere, this cocoon of safety, there's a part of you that feels like, man, that's what I've always wanted. but it's not what you had. I want you to know that here at this church, I want you to know that you're loved, that you are appreciated, that you're not judged in any way. And I understand and I have great appreciation for how painful divorce can be. But it's much more important to understand that God understands. He knows, he feels the pain of his people. And what the Bible says is that God always stands ready to extend grace in abundance from a storehouse that will never be depleted. So if you're going through one of those kinds of moments, or you've gone through divorce, and you're wondering about this, and you feel this moment, I just want you to know that we have a wonderful, merciful God who knows all, sees all, feels your pain as acutely as you do, and is always ready to extend mercy. So even throughout this month, as we talk about, you know, marriage and family and God's ideal, I don't want you to tune out if you've gone through tough moments or maybe are going through tough ones right now. We still are going to hold out God's standard as the ideal and realize that we're just a bunch of sinners. We're always going to fail along the way, but we're still going to pursue and strive for what God has set as the standard. Next week, we're going to talk about the practical side of this in a sermon that I'm going to call Die to Self. And we're going to have some fun working at trying to die to self.